Frequency radio modulation, the big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base deep down.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. I want to jump right into this program today because, well, we have stuff to talk about.
And it's so important.
Always important stuff. In the studios is Armando Ibarra. He's the director of the Chicano and Latina Studies Program at the UW, and he's also an associate professor in the School for Workers. His work is primarily focused on, among other concerns, Chicano, Latino working communities, adult education on issues of diversity in the workplace, and organizing, international labor migration, and leadership development. But far from being a mere academic, Armando has been engaged in numerous projects directly concerned with the lives of working-class Latinos across Wisconsin and elsewhere, including most recently work with Voces de la Frontera, the foremost immigrant workers organization certainly in Wisconsin, and one of the most significant of organizations fighting against, reaction against working people, Latino and Chicano, Mexicano migrants. So, you know, Armando, my friend, welcome back. I do want to mention, of course, that, you know, we're talking about his book, his newly released book, a joint co-authorship, The Latino Question, Politics, Labor and Classes, and the Next Left with Alfredo Carlos and Rodolfo Torres. So, Armando, welcome.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Let's jump in here. And that is this new book, The Latino Question, Politics, Labor and Classes, and the Next Left, is clearly, on numerous levels, a broad-ranging political intervention. Right? It's not just a monograph. It's not just a scholarly work. It's that and much, much more, because it's taking head-on a number of key questions involving social organization, political organization, politics, class and identity politics as living in the real world right now. So talk about it. Talk about how you came to this project, this origins. Clearly, since it's an intervention, you saw the need for an intervention.
Yes. So this is a project that even it's before me and it's before other folks. It's been in the making even prior to me undertaking it. And let me explain what I mean by that. So one of our academic mentors of all three of us, his name is Gilbert Gonzalez, and he's got some really seminal work up there about working class Mexican Americans. He actually published a book called Chicanos, 100 Years of Chicano History, not 100 Years of Latino History or Mexican American History, but him and Raul Fernandez published 100 Years of Chicano History, which is basically an overview of the political economy between Mexico and the U.S. that centers working class Mexicans in the development of the U.S. enterprise. Okay, so Mexican labor is part of U.S. history in a nutshell there. And so from this, we were able to build on his work and other folks' work with the work of one of my academic mentors as well, Rodolfo Torres, who has been a seminal person, a critique, a Marxist, right? Somebody who interjects class into analysis of daily lived realities of people. In this case, it happens to be Latino working class people, in mostly in the LA area. Along with Rudy is Alfredo Carlos, right? Alfredo Carlos is a brilliant young scholar and social activist in the Long Beach area whose focus is on democratizing workplaces. What a concept, right? Democracy in your workplace. And the way he does it is by looking at cooperatives, workplace cooperatives, where the actual working people are the owners of their labor and the capital that they produce, right? So a radical shift from the way things are done today, even within labor management relations, when we talk about workplace cooperatives. And then there is myself, right, the lead author of this publication, whose job really has been to try to center the voices of all three of our narratives and all three of our scholarship. My scholarship and my work centers around working class immigrant and Mexican American communities, mostly in the Central Valley in California, but also here in Wisconsin. One thing that we posit early on in this book is that you cannot understand the position, the Latino position, in the U.S. without understanding the historical roots of empire building in the Americas, in Latin America, by the U.S.
Armando Ibarra, what is the Latino question? The title suggests that there's a preeminent or a central fundamental question that you're looking to address. It such titles, they harken back to a much longer tradition on the left, endless tracts, pamphlets, tomes, essays about the national question or the Jewish question or, to use the old term, the Negro question, very much debated here in the United States, and paralleling it, of course, the Mexican question. So what is the Latino question?
That is the centrality of this work, is to try to get to the essence of the Latino question in U.S. politics. First of all, is to question the whole notion of labels, right? To question this idea of Latino, not necessarily Latinidad or the process of becoming Latino, but what it means to be a Latino in the U.S. And as it is, stands right now, a Latino in the U.S. is everything and nothing. And so what we do is, when we talk about that everything, everybody from Latin America that speaks Spanish is considered Latino. And what does that mean within the U.S. context? It's really difficult to center any type of a positionality that this category has with regards to politics in the U.S. So what we say is that in order to understand the Latino question, we got to understand the class question and reintroduce class into a discussion of Latinos in the U.S. Without understanding the material conditions that Latinos, working class Latinos, that they engage with in their daily lives, then we can't really understand the Latino working community itself. You know, in other words, if we look at Latino on its face value as a label, it obscures rather than clarifies these very social complex relationships that communities have in the U.S., but also in their home countries for those that are still attached.
What I liked very much about the book, that it forced me to think about breaking down that huge kind of monolithic notion of, because it's, and it's filled, of course, our political discourse, especially in the election cycles, right, is filled with, the various aspects of it. The sleeping giant myth, sure. Right, that you lay out as a myth, something called the Latino vote, right? And then there's this Browning narrative, and so on, which is part of the whole cycle of the Latino threat fear, and so on. But it's monolithic, and I was really amazed. You know, I'm just kind of behind the curve, admittedly, on so much of this. For instance, I never think of Los Angeles as an example as being at this point in time a majority Latino city. True. Right? And there's other ones across around the country.
California in itself is a minority-majority state now, right? When there is no majority group anymore, and Latinos occupy a very, population-wise, a very a very special place in California politics. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about what you're alluding to. And this is the demographic shift that's taking place today here in our country, here in our city of Madison, right? Let's as a microcosm of this larger conversation of the so-called, and these are air quotes, Browning of America, and what we're and how we're changing as a country demographically, is what is at the central, I think, anxiety of most anti-immigrant, anti moving forward, since it is our state motto, I'll say it. But it's the demographic shift, right? So there's approximately, let's take Dayton County, approximately 7 to 8% of the population is Latino, right? In a place like Fitchburg, the city of Fitchburg, there's about 17% that's self-identified as Latino, right? In the state of Wisconsin, let's say there's 500,000 Latinos, which occupy a large portion of the state population. That in itself tells us quite a bit, right? It tells us that there's a population increase that's not slowing down. And this demographic shift is taking place because, well, in a place like Wisconsin, because of three primary reasons. First is the birth rate within the self-identified Latino population. Second, it's the think about this, the in-migration from other Latinos from other states to Wisconsin, and international migration from other countries, other Latin American countries to Wisconsin. Given all that, let's talk about that Latino population's and complicate it a little bit. Okay, it's the Latino population in Wisconsin is mostly Mexican or Mexican American. Okay, so about 65% of the Latino population in Wisconsin is Mexican. So they're attached to what we call that empire theory of migration. This idea that immigration from Mexico to the U.S. is rooted in mass labor migration, meaning that we've got, you know, for over a century, movement of people that are being displaced in Mexico, being placed on the internal migration trail, and ultimately into the international labor migration trails, and integrated into different systems of production in the U.S. And it's an intentional process, right? There's a reason when we ask the question, when we pose a question, why are there so many Mexican and Mexican Americans throughout the Southwest? And now, why is that population in Wisconsin as well? Okay, those are real big questions when we start talking about the larger Latino question that we try to unpack in our book. And what we say is this, quite simply, that there are few interdependent actors when it comes to mass labor migration from Mexico to the U.S.
Meaning
that somebody doesn't wake up one day and says, today is the day that I am going to migrate to the U.S. to go work in the service sector in construction or something. Today is the day that that I will leave my family, my community, my attachment to history. Today is the day that we will that I will migrate. What we say is that there's macro level actors here that are being perpetuated by the U.S. by U.S. foreign policy and capital interests that create the conditions for people who are forced to make those types of decisions. You know, in the book, we outline that very methodically by talking about different epochs in Mexican mass labor migration to the U.S., first beginning at the turn of the century, 1880 to about 1910, the Porfirio Diaz regime, then talking a little bit more about the Bracero program, the border industrialization program, and lately, which we're entering a new phase of it, but the North American Free Trade Agreement. These policy interventions that the U.S. has used in Mexico to control basically its economic structures. So all of that is laid out in the book, and I think we've done a very good job in making our argument for the empire theory of migration.
Well, it's that empire theory of migration, of course, melds very nicely with a longer understanding of the motions of empire. Yes. Of capital accumulation. That is, this, what the sociologists in a very simplistic fashion talk about, oh, there's push-pull factors, right? Which totally avoids the motions of underdevelopment, of
purposeful,
uneven purposeful development, the forcing of people, you know, across the global South, especially in Latin America, in regard to the U.S., the forcing of people off the land into the cities, into motion, migration to larger cities, to attractive poles in El Norte. So we
articulate that by really building on Gilbert's work of, and they talk about the ideology and practice of empire, okay? And this ideology and practice of empire is really creating this discourse of a racialization that's used to create not just the justification to be able to carry out these underdevelopment projects, right? But also to place the Mexican labor into this rank taxonomy of racialized workers in the U.S. So we lay all that out as well. But let me read just three things out real quick that that speak directly to what we're talking about. And these are quotes that we have in our book with regards to empire. Pushing American enterprise up to and within Mexico, wherever it can properly go, he claimed, will give us advantages which force and money alone would hardly procure. It will give us a peaceful conquest of the country. William S. Rosecrans. This quote was made during the time after the Mexican-American War, and the discussion was what to do with Mexico, what to do with the newly acquired territories, but what to do with Mexico. There was discussion in this country whether all of Mexico would be annexed into the U.S., right, and basically putting Mexico in some sort of trusteeship, and then deciding what to do. The policy at this point was, if we control the economy of Mexico, then we control the sovereignty of Mexico. Okay. Another quote. Pobre de Mexico, tan lejos de Dios y tan cerca de los Estados Unidos. Poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States. And this is a quote that's attributed to the dictator, or we will call him the despot, Diaz, who ruled over Mexico between 1880 and 1910, which was really the initial phase of modernization of capital interjection into Mexico by foreign powers, and really the impetus for Mexico's current economic position today. It harkens back to 1880. He, the migrant, is forced to seek better conditions north of the border by the slow but relentless pressure of the United States agriculture, financial, and oil corporate interest on the entire economic and social evolution of the Mexican nation. Ernesto Galarza, Program for Action, 1949. He published this in Commonweal, with some of you out there might know this publication, but it's Ernesto Galarza, and they're all talking in the same way. And finally, domination. When we talk about empire and domination, there's John Foster Dulles in 1950 said there's two ways to conquer a country. You can invade it militarily or control it financially.
Gee, this sounds so present for some reason.
and so that is the ideology behind the practice of empire in this political, economic, social engineering of relationships between Mexico and the U.S. that have created the conditions for mass labor migration, and really points out to that Mexican question that we just posed as to why are there so many Mexican and Mexican Americans in the U.S.
We've used the word intervention, right? There's layerings, levels of interventions in this book. You're polemicizing, in a sense, carrying on a political intervention against other lines that are out there, other dominant interpretations of attempts at interpretations at social reality and who we are as a people, a diverse people. Part of the book clearly is an intervention against a dominant identity politics kind of argument.
Sure.
That often across the board diverse separates class out. Right, class doesn't exist. There's just this group, this ethnic group, this people, and there's no classes within it. And I'm answering my own question here, but talk about that intervention.
Yeah. So one of the reasons for writing this book is as students of social change and social movement, and as folks that have engaged in actual social movement organizations. Rodolfo Torres, Alfredo Carlos, and myself, as political scientists as well, right? So we're in this discipline that has really used categories of people to talk about the political being itself, right? And by this, we're talking about the polity and how people react within that. Well, we found ourselves marginalized when we talked about the Latino question, right? With regards to how Latinos are either transforming or not the social realities that they live in. And for this, you know, it was very difficult to get out of the trap of identity politics, meaning that when we talk about identity politics, especially where we were at, it's to talk about, to not talk about the specificity of what it means to be a Latino. And by a specificity, we mean is what is it that conditions the lived realities and the identity of people that are being integrated into our economy, into our capitalist economy within this neoliberal frame today.
And your response, your answer?
Is that it's what we do to survive the conditions or that sets the terms of how of our identity. So class matters in this sense. So in order to explain the Latino, you have to understand how that population works within capitalist production and those processes of production. And that explains the identity of the community much more than many other identity primers.
Right. And of course, the bulk, the vast majority of Latino workers occupy, tiers, stratas, vocations, I can't even say professions, right?
Sure.
Whether it be in this marvelous chapter in the book about kitchen labor in Los Angeles,
yeah,
or agricultural workers in the Southwest or in Wisconsin, but also breaking through these kind of misconceptions, narrow conceptions of where Latinos work. They work everywhere.
Yes. And the restaurant chapter is really fascinating. It's how do we explain feasting on Latino labor, right? And so that itself is very provocative. So we're talking about the commodification of Mexican cuisine and about a selective selecting what of this Mexican culture that the restaurant industry has done in LA to be able to feast on Latino labor. We love your food. We essentially need your labor, but don't quite need.
Don't come out of the kitchen.
That's right. That's right. And I often, when I do public talks, I mention that you go down, let's go downtown on State Street. Any restaurant, just listen to the kitchen. I don't care what type of restaurant it is, listen to the kitchen, and you more than likely will hear Spanish language media or Spanish being spoken in the kitchen. But as you said, Alan, stay in the kitchen. So it's this idea that this labor is absolutely essential to feasting on Latino labor, but at the same time, it's a labor that's being exploited by this industry itself. When we talk about Wisconsin in general, you know, I often look at the dairy industry as an example as to Latino labor, right? We know that we are the dairy state, right? Wisconsin is a dairy state. Our motto is forward. But the dairy state only survives and in some instances thrives because of Latino labor. the majority of that labor being undocumented folks, meaning that it's folks that are here without proper, without an immigration status, right? So it's kind of ironic that, like, in the dairy state, where we talk about forward, that our model that we like to promote only functions because of unauthorized Latino labor. So is feasting, as much as we feast on Latino labor in LA in that case study, we are feasting on Latino labor in the dairy state.
I want to come back to a concept that you guys use that I found very provocative, very informative. That is this notion of what is cultural political economy?
That's the middle ground, right? Between cultural and political economy. The idea that we can explain the formation of culture by studying political economy, right? It's not just an identity that's produced because of working class relationships in a capitalist society or in a capitalist economy, but also a culture that is coming from that as well. So cultural political economy, you know, from the Lancaster School and from those folks, are really looking at that middle ground as to how we can advance this conversation about working class and the production of culture at the same time.
Give us an example of that. That is, for our listener here, it's at some level it's an abstraction, right? But so, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so an example of that is the Latino question, right? So the Latino question can only be understood by the culture that's being produced within the political economy of capitalist production in the U.S., meaning that the Latino position or the Latino community within the U.S. is a product of the relationship of the working class relationship that folks have in the ways that they integrate into production and systems of production. To be a Latino cannot be the culture that's built around being a Latino cannot be understood apart from understanding the relationship that this working class has within the political economy.
You know, there's the old, it won't even come to me right now, who kind of coined the concise phrase, but clearly the fear, the concern, the fear whipped up by politicians in regard to the undocumented, the people streaming across the border, and so on, suggest to me that they have a very real political concern, yeah. Right? That for a good decade and a half now, some of the most important, significant working class initiatives have come out of the Latino and Mexicano communities, mm-hmm. communities writ large. And there's a concern there. It gets back to this thing about the Browning, and the fact that there are minority-majority cities. That strange term, that strange dialectic there. Mm-hmm. But seriously, this whole, and that leads, of course, to the last part of the book, and it's in the subtitle as well, you know, toward a new left, right? What happens when you get a whole strata, some of the most exploited levels of the working class in the United States? What happens when they get politicized? Not in the narrow sense of electoralism or whatever, but conscious political actors.
Sure. So first, I want to step back real quick since you said it, I wasn't going to use this word, the dialectical, right? And since you brought it up, that's what we're talking about.
The yin and the yang of our world.
Well, you know, when we're talking, I didn't want to use that word on purpose, but, you know, the cultural political economy is the dialectical there between cultural and political economy. You know, what is it, the discourse that's taking place there?
Oh, you used the word I wasn't going to use discourse.
Well, that's central to the ideology of practice of empire. But the question about the next left and why it's so prominent in our work is it's not as complicated as most folks might think. It's rooted in this idea that's rooted in working class relationships that, that people have. If you read the book, what you'll see in each one of those chapters is an intervention of sorts of how to democratize production relations. Okay, think about that workplace democracy, and that
what
workplace democracy, and in some instances with the cooperatives, ownership of your own labor and how you sell it within our system. Okay. And so what we're saying is I think what we're seeing parts of it manifest themselves even in DC right now with Ocasio and other social democrats, right? That there is a growing working class ideology that is tied into this empire theory of migration. That is tied into this idea of we bring in Gramsci too, you know, that whole idea of organic intellectuals, you know. We also talk about Ferrer.
Yeah, you're very, when I was reading it, you know, reading this stuff, I said, yeah, Armando's really an organic intellectual.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what that means, but yeah.
You're bionic, excuse me.
But this is, what we're saying is that the enterprise is that folks are becoming class conscious, and then becoming class conscious and being part of this working class, that those politics are going to be part of the mainstream. And if you have working class politics as affecting the mainstream, then they're pulling those politics to the left, right? So we have a politics that's being pulled to the left because of the growing working class consciousness within this growing Latino workforce, that we're kind of seeing some of the remnants today. And this is what's pushing back against capital.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people talk about Bernie Sanders as bringing back socialism, the word, back into mainstream political discourse, right? I think we have to argue, as you just alluded to, that it's Bernie being pushed from below.
Yeah.
His positions have not been static. He continues to evolve, and of course the other side of the coin is, as I've talked about numerous occasions on this program, is the reintroduction of fascism, right? The reaction that to use that word again, that dialectic, the historic monster, this question of this new left,
mm-hmm.
right, and coming. Not from left intellectuals, but from the realities that give rise to mobilization, give rise to organizing, that give rise to people saying basta, right? Enough. So fantastic to me.
So part of the reason of the next intervention here that we talk about, multiple interventions, is to talk about the power of working class Latinos in social movements. And we talk about labor as one of the social movements that Latino labor has been able to revive in some cases. And we also look at LA and California to talk about labor. But we also look at the social movement that's around immigrant and labor rights. This idea that people that exchange their labor for wages in this country have rights, and one of those rights is to be able to exist within this nation state without the fear of being, you know, persecuted or hunted down by the nation state. And that is one thing that we saw in 2006. For most folks that were a part of the immigrant rights social movement protest in 2006, at that point in our history, it was the single largest protest in our history, okay, 2006. 1 million people march in LA. In Wisconsin, 70,000 people took to the streets to protest the criminalization by proposed legislation from a person from right here in Wisconsin to try to move the agenda towards comprehensive immigration reform. This idea that we can adjust people's status so that they can integrate fully into our communities without having to be scared of being ripped apart from their families, from their communities. That was in 2006 and continues to this day. The work by social movement organizations in Wisconsin, including Voces de la Frontera, which is one of many, in this fight for immigrant rights, it has been essential to the Latino question. Christine Newman Ortiz, there will be books written about her organizing in Milwaukee. Mark my words, and in this country, simply because she has really been at the intersections of working class immigrants, working class non-immigrants, and also being able to engage with other folks in other social movement mm-hmm. organizations to push back against inequality. And that is the work that's going to bring the next left to the center.
Perhaps some final words. What do you have in the works?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's always something in the works. So I am currently working on a book titled Testimonios of Working Class Mexican and Mexican Americans in the 21st Century. And basically, it's a work that emulates Studs Terkel's work around working. And so I've been on this project for about a year and a half, and hopefully in about another year, we'll be able to have another conversation with you, Alan, about that.
Well, when you told me a long time ago that you were working on this current book, I said, well, I'll have you on. So you have an open invitation, my friend. I want to thank our dear friend and font of knowledge and struggle, Armando Ibarra. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our...